Hi, I'm Astrid, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I want to thank everybody who helped put this on, and thank you for inviting me. And Kristen, thank you for picking me up, taking me back to the airport. And I know how much it takes to pull something like this off. It takes a lot of people, a lot of help, a lot of manpower, and it's a miracle. It really is. And it's an honor and it's a privilege. I don't take it for granted when I get asked to speak and somebody pays for my airfare, round trip ticket, my hotel room. That was a lot of $1 bills in a basket. It was. And it's a beautiful thing. Really, it's God-given. I'm an alcoholic, and I suffer from alcoholism even when I don't have a drink, and I haven't had a drink for many years. And I've really picked the disease apart, and I've picked apart my defects, and I've inventoried and inventoried, and I've really discovered a lot about myself and how the disease operates in me. And looking back, I came from a childhood where there was a lot of mayhem. There was a lot of screaming and yelling. There was spanking, hitting. My parents were fighting a lot. My mother's a German war survivor. So there was no way to really process pain. If I was upset or my feelings were hurt, it was like, you know, this is just the way it is. And I remember at a really young age just pushing and pushing and pushing down my feelings, like just feeling so frustrated and so aggravated and so angry. And my sisters and I were all very close in age, massive sibling rivalry in the house. I mean, just cat fights, pulling each other's hair, scratching, hitting, slapping. And why this is important to me is because as I've studied the disease of alcoholism and other pathologies, I see that the human being and the human condition, when there's trauma in early childhood, a child's going to pick several different avenues in order to medicate or in order to suppress those feelings or in order to process those feelings. And looking back, I wasn't able to process my emotions. I wasn't able to speak up for myself. And so at a really early age, things were boiling and boiling and boiling inside. And, you know, some people find a healthy outlet. Maybe, you know, they, I don't know, figure out wood carving or painting or something artistic. And I was just destroying things and arguing and screaming and yelling and deep, deep hatred and disturbance inside. And I even remember, like, by the time I was probably 9 or 10, I remember I would lay in bed at night and I would just think, I wish my parents were dead. And looking back, I didn't know that that's not a healthy thought for a child. I had no idea that other people didn't think that way. I didn't. I just thought that's who I was. That's the character that was getting built way before I poured alcohol on her. So as time went on and things escalated, like so many people here, one day I went to a party. You know, I was like 12 or 13 years old. Somebody handed me a Budweiser. I opened it. And I drank some, and alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. And I had a psychic change. And all of a sudden, all of my anger and all of my hostility and all of my frustration temporarily went away. And I was able to communicate better with people. I was able to have eye contact. I was able to just sit and relax. Yeah, this is cool. Right on. We're good. This is good. Budweiser's good. It's good. And for me, I did not experience the phenomenon of craving right away. There was definitely a progression in the disease. And so I remember early in my drinking days, I remember actually having an internal brake pedal where I was able to stop. School still meant something to me. I wanted to graduate high school. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to be a wife. I wanted to own a home. I wanted to have the American dream. I still thought I was going to do all those things. I thought that I was going to achieve all of those things. I thought that I was headed in this direction. But really, the alcoholism is a subtle foe, and the disease is designed not to see itself. So the disease is never going to tell me, girl, you're headed for one brick wall after another after another. Somehow my mind still tells me that I'm going to have success and, you know, all the windows and doors are going to open and I'm going to live in a Disney movie and birds are going to land on my shoulders. But really, as I got older and I started to drink more, I was I was unable to process my feelings, and there was more and more and more stuff just being stuffed down. And if you study the alcoholic, whether they're 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, there are several characteristics. One of them is the inability to accept frustration. We're incredibly thin-skinned. Our feelings get hurt really easily. It's very rare to find an alcoholic that's a total psychopath slash sociopath. That is a different pathology. We're sensitive. We're thin-skinned. We can't handle rejection. We can't handle frustration. But I didn't know those things. And so as time goes on, I'm not internally maturing because I'm pouring more and more alcohol. And at some point, I cross over the invisible line. And it's called an invisible line because it's an invisible line, so I don't know when I crossed over it. But there was one day somewhere where I, like everybody else in here, lost the freedom of choice, and that was it. I woke up in the morning, and it's beer 30 every single day. Every day, every day. And now I'm just about to graduate high school. I can still, like, get good grades. I can still make it on time. But I'm drinking, and I'm drinking all the time. And I'm mildly intoxicated, but I'm not totally wet-brained yet. I haven't completely destroyed myself. There's still a sparkle inside. And I apply to colleges, and I don't do very well. And I pick bad boyfriends, and I'm always getting in fights and arguments. And it's interesting, because I come from a background where there was a lot of household violence. What my pattern is going to be is I want a boyfriend that's going to knock the crap out of me. If you have a restraining order with several women, I'm in love. And it's not like, I mean, like to say my picker's broken is just such a mild version of serious pathology. Like, really, the worse they are, the more cynical, the more cruel, the colder they are, the more my heart beats for them. And it's interesting because even with 12 years of sobriety now and picking this apart and inventorying it, my heart still isn't totally healed. The first thought is I'm attracted to the bad guy. The second thought is that's not at all where God wants me to be. And, you know, I'm hardwired for what I came out of. And so as time goes on, reckless relationships, fighting, crazy, mayhem, screaming, arguing, DUIs, problems, 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 problems. And at one point, I got sober. I couldn't stand it anymore. I got sober and I went to AA. And I didn't hear the message. And I just did what they told me to do in a very robotic way. And, you know, show up. In those days, you could smoke cigarettes. Clean up the ashtrays, you know, make the coffee, you know, stick with the winners, get a sponsor, get a winner sponsor. I don't even know what a winner sponsor is. I think a winner sponsor, maybe she has the most money and really big tits and nails and a fast car. And she used to be a hooker and now she's married to a lawyer. I would think, like, that seemed like a winner to me. I want her to be my sponsor. She won. She got prizes and cash and things out there. I don't know, you know. And I have no idea what humility is, or being humble, or backing down, or being patient, or allowing things to unfold. And so what I did was I did AA as a homework assignment. And I just rushed through steps 1, 2, and 3, and I never knew what it was like to be restored to soundness of mind, and I never knew what it was like to turn my will and my life over. I took the third step prayer as this thing I do once. I just get on my knees and I do this thing, and something's going to happen, me and Glinda the good witch, and we're going to get out, man. Oz is coming, we're going to float away in the balloon, and you know, and then I, you know, do 4 and 5, and I kept thinking something's going to happen, you know, I think something happened in 5, but I'm not really sure. And you know, it's an important topic to talk about because I can't tell you how many people I've seen complete a fifth step and then secretly come and say, I just feel so sick and something didn't happen. And I thought something was supposed to happen and what the heck. And you know what? It's okay because neuroscience tells us that these memories live in our cells at a cellular level, and to just vomit something out in a continuous stream in a fifth step isn't enough to get rid of it. I have to bring God into every moment of my life. And so there are some myths with the steps that I didn't know in the beginning. I just kept thinking if I did the homework right, maybe if I used cursive this time and I didn't print, it would be better. I got to get another notebook. I buy a really expensive pen. You know? All these outer things, never really looking at the inside and seeing that the character's not really changing. It's one thing to identify my defects and what I've done wrong, but it's another thing to really have my heart mind completely shift so that I'm an open, receptive vessel for God to download. And I didn't have any of that. I remained restless, irritable, and discontent. And as everybody in here knows, alcoholism awaits at every man and woman's elbow to resume its destruction. And it'll wait so patiently and so quietly in the corner. It'll wait for years. And the disease is progressive. So inside I get sicker and sicker. Plugs in the jug and I'm so mad and I'm driving down the freeway and it's my freeway and everybody needs to move over and get out of my lanes. What the hell's going on here? And I'm telling people off and don't you know who I think I am? And I'd never heard a term untreated alcoholism. I don't know what untreated alcoholism is. You know, we just call it dry drunk, stinking thinking. Oh no. Oh, that is like so mild compared to like what was going on inside of me. And so, like the book says, if I don't have a total psychic change, the chances are very big that it's going to be me in the bottle someday and the bottle is going to win. And unfortunately, the statistics are there's only 2 to 5% of alcoholics ever take a 5-year cake. So most of the people in this room have under 5 years of sobriety. And as people get older in the teens and 20s and 30s, they'll even tell you they have very few friends that have 30 years of sobriety. It gets more and more rare. That's scary to me. My life is really valuable to me today. My seat and my physical sobriety is so valuable to me, I cannot even tell you. A drink is the furthest thing from my mind. I try to practice these principles in all of my affairs. I work so hard this second time around. Oh, no, you don't. But I didn't know that. And so I got into another relationship with a guy, and it starts arguing, and we start screaming and yelling. And now I've also got a child. I have a 10-year-old kid, and she starts to see all this crazy mayhem, and her mom's frustrated and angry all the time. And then one day I just decided I just needed to quiet my mind. It was killing me. I was so agitated. I was restless, irritable, discontent. I need something. I just need something to shut me up. And I go and I get a bottle and I completely forgot about the phenomenon of craving. Totally forgot that characteristic of the disease of alcoholism. So I open this bottle of champagne and I drink some, and I remember that very first drink was so good because my disease hadn't been treated. For 11 years, hadn't been treated, and I got quiet inside, and I thought, oh my God, phew, it's go quiet. And then I remember the very next morning I woke up, and planning committee was on. How are we going to lie? When are we going to drink again? How much can we drink? Can we drink during the week? Should we drink on the weekends? How many glasses can we have? How much is too much? How much is not enough? And I actually remember thinking, oh my God. There's a monster in my head. You've got to be kidding me. And I forgot all about the weighing, measuring, hiding lady, you know. I completely forgot that aspect. So I made a couple of really bad ditch efforts to go back to AA, and my mind was shut. I was still like, you know, AA's for losers. I know everything. That shit doesn't work. I tried it the first time. Whatever. You know, that sponsor with the big tits and the nails. You know, and I just like, my mind was shut, and I would go to meetings and I would walk out and I would go get drunk. You know, like there's some sayings that really aren't so great around here. Like one of them, I was talking to someone earlier. I don't like to take the cotton out of your ears and put it anywhere. I think ask as many questions as you can. And also, you know, meeting makers make meetings or something like that, or go to a meeting a day and it'll keep you sober. It didn't, because I wasn't doing the internal work. I was just robotically showing up. I'm talking about my life. I'm talking about my experience, not yours, not a big survey that I took in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's anonymous, so you can't take a survey. You know, I just know for me, for my own life, it wasn't working. I would go to a meeting that day and I would get drunk that night, and over and over and over and over, the terrible cycle. And you know, in case you all haven't noticed, the American Medical Association has now classified alcohol as a depressant. So every morning I wake up and I'm so hungover I want to kill myself. right? And now I start going to a psychiatrist, you know, therapist. How much are you drinking? Oh, not that much. You know, a glass of wine here and there. I just really want to fucking kill myself. I think I need meds. You know, I mean, how many of us have gone through that type of deception also? Like, I don't even know the truth from the false. I'm really full flight from reality, downright mental defect. But again, the disease is designed not to see itself. You see, it's a living entity. It's a parasite. It needs a host. Alcoholism is a parasite and it needs a host. It needs to live off of something. And it gets in me, and the main part of the illness centers in my mind. And it speaks to me with such great authority, and it uses my life. It uses my words. It uses my stories. It uses my opinions. It uses my desires. It uses my warped instinct for sex, security, and approval. It'll use anything just to energize itself and to stay alive. And it's always dark and it's always negative. Alcoholism never has a bright idea. Ever, 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 ever. If it came from me, all hell's gonna break loose. So as time goes on, things go from bad to worse, and I literally cannot control my drinking anymore, and now I'm drunk around the clock, and I'm starting to spend all my savings. I'm starting to borrow money out of my house that's almost paid off. My daughter's in a private school. She's getting weepy. She's sad all the time. I'm creating so much trauma and horrible like pathology in her. She doesn't feel secure. You know, she's getting all kinds of phobia. She's looking at me cockeyed. I'm not safe. I mean, I'm doing major damage. I'm dragging a child through the wake of untreated alcoholism. And these people did an intervention. They came over to my house and they just asked if they could take my daughter while I go into treatment. And I went into treatment over and over, and it never happened. And I just gave my daughter to some people after 11 years old, raised my daughter. I breastfed for 3 years, put her in a Waldorf school, all organic food, read her stories to sleep every night. You know, every birthday was an amazing affair. And now her mom's drunk as a skunk, and I can't even put a toaster waffle in the frickin' toaster. Like, really, that whole thing, you know, Bill Wilson's kind of mean in the Big Book, where he's like, with the men, he's like, out come the carpet slippers, and with the women, he's like, oh man, that woman went down so fast and so hard, she was unrecognizable in a couple of weeks, you know? Anyway, this one's for you, Bill. You know? Okay, so anyway, I spiral down that drain with no carpet slippers, you know? And things go from bad to worse, and I eventually just move out into the street. And I lived in the street for a good portion of the year 2000, 2001, 2002, and part of 2003. And I just drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I... Drugs are part of my story, and I am an AA woman all the way across the board, and I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't get up at the podium and name other drugs, but I can tell you one thing. The landscape of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed dramatically. And if we think that we're all going to get sponsees that are straight alcoholics and all these little 15 and 20-year-old kids only have a drinking problem, there won't be any sponsees for us. So I have to change to meet the conditions of what's going on out there. These children are snorting psych meds. They're drinking cold medicine. They're creating chemicals that are just really, really messing up their minds. These children, they almost don't have a chance. It's so scary. You never see a kid standing at the liquor store anymore with a $5 bill going, hey, will you buy me a six-pack? Those days are gone. So the landscape has changed, and I want to meet the conditions of whatever it is. I want to be there for the next person, and I know that Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob would be so happy. They really would. I mean, we have to evolve as this disease evolves. We have to, or I don't know. It's not AA. You know, things have changed, dramatically changed. Anyway, so I move out into the street and I'm coupling drugs with alcohol, but vodka was always the main staple in my life. And, you know, the streets are a crazy, ugly, kooky place. I mean, it's kill or be killed, and I've been in and out of jail. I have 23 prostitution cases and 18 drug and alcohol related cases. I have 5 DUIs. Alcohol destroyed my life. I mean, it took everything from me, every ounce of dignity, every bit of moral fiber, everything that was good in me, everything. I was just an empty shell, just wandering around completely unconscious for several years, just dirty, filthy, homeless, you know. And every once in a while, I would have like a moment of clarity where I would just think, how did this happen? Like, there's no bridge back to safety. I knew it was over. Like, the idea of ever even seeing a driver's license again or a social security card or flicking lights on in a house, you know? Like, I remember one time this trick picked me up in the street, and usually I would just do everything in a car and it would be over in 5 seconds. And I remember this guy took me to his house because he lived right off a beaten track. And I walk into his house, and he's like, come on, go on this way. And I remember just seeing his kitchen and thinking to myself, it has been so long since I have seen a stove. I can't believe it. I just said, just wait for a minute. Just wait a minute. And I just stood there, like, looking at this guy's kitchen, because that's how disconnected I was from that world, from that life. It's so sad. It's so tragic what this disease can do. Alcoholics are good inside. There was goodness in me. To say that I'm just a mother that abandoned her child, I'm telling you, I cried almost every day of my life. But the disease is so much stronger than self-will. It's a giant compared to the disease. I mean well, but I cannot do well. I just can't. I want to be good. I want to get straight. I want to get sober. I want to do the right thing. But every day, I wake up and I'm back in the disease. Doomsday is here and I can't do it, and my will is weak, and the parasite says, let's go do the same thing over and over, expect a different result. We'll try again tomorrow. And days, weeks, months, and even years go on, and everything's just a blank blackout. And all the while, there's a child growing up without a mother in somebody else's home. Thank God they were such loving, good people. You know, and they put her in therapy, and they took really good care of her. She's an amazing person today, and I'll talk about that a little later. But anyway, as time went on, things just went from bad to worse, and I just kept getting arrested and getting arrested. And every time I'd go to jail, the judge would say, Miss Howe, don't you want to go to drug diversion? And I'd be like, death before detox, I'm not going, you know. I'm not going, you know. And I'd just go back out into the street again over and over. I can't stand those places. I hate that stuff. And eventually the disease beat me down so badly, I remember really knowing that I was psychotic. I actually remember knowing that my brain was fried. I actually was clear enough to know I can't hold a conversation with people anymore. I can't keep eye contact. I can't remember what she just said. I could see that my skills had diminished way down to a primal level. And there was this guy in the street, this trick, Mr. Captain Save-A-Ho, who probably needed Al-Anon. And he'd come visit me in jail and put money on my books and think he was going to turn me into a fairy princess or I don't know what, you know. Everybody's got their issues. And he'd come to jail every time I'd be in there, and he would sit on the other side of the glass and he'd say, don't you want to go to treatment, you know? Don't you want to get better? And eventually I did. I started to go into treatment, and then I'd go back in the street again, into treatment, and back in the street again. By the way, I mean, if we could see all the money that's been spent on all the people in here for treatment, it would be stacked to the ceiling. It's really unbelievable. There's a lot of people making a lot of money off recovery out there. That's a whole nother topic. Don't even get me started. Because I'm telling you, Betty Ford or the back of a Ford, there's one that has all power. You know, that one is God. May we all find him now, you know. Yale, jail, all of those things, you know. It's really a simple program. You know, I don't need a $50,000 big book. I just need some willingness inside of me. So this guy starts paying for rehabs, and every time I get sober, my heart just aches for my daughter. I feel so sick and so dirty and so guilty, and I think to myself, God, my daughter's like 13 and she's a virgin and I've got all these prostitution cases. I mean, how am I ever going to take my kid back? What am I going to do? Try to be a mother? Like, how is this even going to work out? You know, I mean, I just couldn't even see that there was a possibility of me integrating myself into the fabric of her life. I just couldn't, I could not figure out why or how. So anyway, I was at this one rehab. I was at the ABC Club out in Indio, California, Danny Leahy and Helen. And somebody handed me these tapes of this guy named Bob Anderson who started this meeting in Sherman Oaks, California. It's called Primetime. And our format at that meeting is we talk about alcoholism, ego, and self. We don't talk about drunkologues, yesterday's problems, or blaming other people. We talk only about looking inward. And he said, the main part of the disease centers in my mind rather than my body, and that I'm the same woman drunk as I am sober if I don't have a psychic change. And this just blew the top of my head right off, because I kept thinking that the alcoholism was in the liquid. I was so sure it was in the bottle, and it never occurred to me or dawned on me or struck me that the main part of the disease centers in my mind, and that the whole time, no matter where I am and where I go, the disease is always with me. It's always waiting to ignite itself, and that I don't need liquor to ignite my alcoholism. So if the main part of the disease actually centers in the alcoholic's mind rather than her body, and if in step two I have to come to believe that there's a power, and in step three, I have to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this power, well, then I have to get the power into where the disease is, right? And if the main part of the disease centers in my mind, then I have to get a God consciousness. Then I have to start to allow this power in. These steps are not a race. It's not a homework assignment. It's a way of life. It's an evolutionary spiritual process of burning and discarding the self away so that the God consciousness can shine through, that I live by spiritual principles, that one day at a time I back down and I don't let the old self run the show, that I'm not pushing and shoving, that God grants me the serenity and I can change the things that I can, and I can accept what I can't and maybe move in a different direction. So I start listening to this message, and my whole life is revolutionized, and I can see that the second half of step one, that my life is unmanageable, I realize it's my thought life that's unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol, dash, that my thought life is unmanageable and will be unmanageable forever, of me, by me, with me, by myself. You know, God is God. It does not matter what religion, the insanity of people fighting religions. God is just this infinite intelligence that is in every living cell, every living being. It is life promoting. It is so wise. It knows everything. And when I tap into it, I become intuitively guided. I know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. I don't need to be recognized. I don't need to run the show. I can go back to my daughter's life with 23 prostitution cases. I can do whatever because God is all powerful and self is not there. So when I heard this, I had a lot of hope because I had so much shame about what I'd done and who I was. I just thought, game over for me, you know? So I was taught to start watching the thoughts that surf the waves of my brain. And so first thing in the morning when I would wake up, like, I mean, the fear would just be on my chest like an elephant. And I started to really watch the thoughts. And one of the most repetitive thoughts was, you're not going to make it. I don't even know where I'm supposed to make it to, but you're not going to make it. Like, what, the paparazzi are outside, or there's an award for me somewhere? Like, I don't know where I'm supposed to make it. So I would pick that apart. Really, you're not going to make it. Well, I'm here right now, and I'm breathing, and I've got this power in my life, and I'm going to get up and brush my teeth, and I'm going to make a cup of coffee. Looks like I'm going to make it today. I don't even know where I'm. So I start to see the disease, and I start to see that it speaks to me, and it tells me scary things, and it plays scary movies, and I start to watch it. I start to get a bird's eye perspective, and I hop outside, and I look down below, and I can see that something's just chattering all day long. And for the first time in my life, I have the realization that it's involuntary. The disease is just doing what it does all day long, that there's actually some spiritual schizophrenia going on. That makes me really nice dating material, by the way. So I start to look at my mind and I can see, it, you know, usually it's tied to one of three instincts. My instinct for approval, my instinct for sex, my instinct for security. And sex isn't always just to have a partner. It's even how I express myself as a female. Do I have the right clothes? Do I have the right shoes? Do I have the right car? You know, am I a presentable mother, wife, girlfriend, sponsor? It's all of that kind of stuff. And my security instinct can be right down to just like my shoes, my tires, my cell phone, my whatever, you know. I didn't know how to open a bill without going into untreated alcoholism. I'd go to the mailbox, wham! My head would explode. AT&T, you know. I mean, the reaction didn't fit what was going on. I don't know how to live and act to good purpose. I cannot live in this world without a drink. I couldn't do it. The most simple tasks. There I was, 42 years old, and I can't. The most simple tasks. I cannot function in this world. And so I start to invite this power in. And what I start to do is, before I even get out of bed in the morning, I just say, power, whatever you are, can you just be with me? Like, I don't even know what you are. I'll set aside everything I think I know. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit. Just let me empty myself out of all preconceived ideas because I don't know anything about you, God. I'm not going to burn in hell. I'm not going to hell right now. I don't even know what my conception is, but they said that you could help me if I asked you to help me. Can you help me? Because my mind's trying to mug me. There's a lynch mob in my basement, and it's trying to take me out. And it's telling me that I'm a dirty whore, that I'm never going to have a job, that what is the use? You should just find a loaded gun and blow your brains out. And because there really is a power, I start to get relief. And now I just start talking to this power all day long, and I stop talking to the disease, and I just keep asking and petitioning with my heart, mind, power, you gotta help me. I can't get through the day. Everybody bothers me. I hate them. I wish I had an Uzi, you know. Not. I wish these people would disappear, you know. I can't wait at the line in Starbucks. They're not moving fast enough, you know. The lady in Vons, what the hell? Now you pull your checkbook out, all those coupons. What's the matter with you? You know, don't you know who I am? I'm the hooker from the street, you know. Insanity. My ego is for sure not my amigo. It's completely infected with untreated alcoholism. And I start to see that there's something really wrong, you know. In the 12 and 12, Bill Wilson says, I'm willing to term myself a problem drinker, but I can't accept that I'm in fact mentally ill. You know, and in step 8, he says, very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. At some times, these emotions have given us violent twists, which have discolored the pattern of our lives forever. I'm damaged. I am not kidding you. I am damaged goods. And my liabilities turn out to be my greatest asset, because there's no way that I can transmit this message to you unless I didn't suffer my ass off for this thing. I am not kidding you. I am not kidding, man. This thing, this disease is a killer. And if you're here in 90 degree heat in Austin, Texas on a Friday night, there's something wrong with you too. You know? We didn't order this. We thought it was all going to be so different. How the heck did we wind up here? And yet the miracle is, thank God we did wind up here, because anybody that knows anything about pre-AA, I mean, especially for women, it's like, give her a lobotomy and a hysterectomy, tie her up in a gown and, you know, put her in a rubber room and take her kids away. I mean, it was no joke to be an alcoholic female in the 30s or 40s or even the 50s. It was not a funny thing. And there's so much help for us today, and we are allergic to alcohol. We'll be allergic to alcohol forever. Our bodies don't process alcohol the way other people do. 6% of the population are allergic to alcohol, and it creates a phenomenon of craving. What you do, some people swing from the chandelier, some people get in fights, some people get in blackouts, some people laugh, and some people have a great time. Who knows? But the thing is that once we start, we can't stop. And so there are these 12 steps, and there are treatment for this disease. And that's what I have to apply to my life on a daily basis. And for me, if I don't have step one, two, and three in place as the foundation for my life, I have no business doing a fearless and thorough moral inventory, because it's not going to be fearless and thorough, because I'm terrified of what I've done and who I am and what you're going to think of me and how am I ever going to get into 8 and 9 and tell people that I want to make amends and clean things up. So it's my heart that has to heal, and sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. You know, sometimes I see people and they just blossom and unfold, and other people it takes them years, and it's the progress in here. It's not the perfection. Thank God for that. And I just kept doing 1, 2, and 3 and doing 1, 2, and 3, inviting God into my life. And I started to get so much relief that I could see that it was quite possible that I could live by spiritual principles, that I could be a new character with no reference to the old. And I started to have contact with my daughter, and we started to go to therapy. You know, I have had so much help along the way. I thank God for all the help. You know, gratitude and forgiveness are like two of the highest vibrational frequencies there are. I don't even know that there's anything higher. But gratitude and forgiveness, and I couldn't even be grateful in the beginning for all the help. I just wanted more, because it's a disease of more. I could barely even say thank you. But looking back, the more I look back and the longer I stay with this message and with this God, the more grateful I am, because that's the evolution. Evolutionary process of the God consciousness. But you know, in the beginning, the first time I ever saw my daughter, it was in a therapy session, and the therapist, she said, don't touch your daughter, don't try to hug her, and do not start crying, do not apologize to her. And I remember thinking, God dang, that is some weird stuff. I'm so glad the therapist told me that, because I would have just been all crazy and mushy, and I had to just sit there and like hold my composure and watch this child walk in and sit across from me, and just, the therapist said, just do small talk. And I had to take a lot of baby steps along the way. I didn't just poof have this miraculous life. Yay, you know, now I'm in AA, everything's good. So many things had to happen along the way. And we started to go to therapy, and then when my daughter was in 10th grade, she moved back in with me. I got an apartment, and I was able to finish out her high school. You know, I even remember telling the therapist, I know I'm sober, I want to stay sober, but I don't want to take my daughter back. It's too much responsibility. Thank God, you know that therapist? She looked me right in the eye, and she said, let me tell you, you don't take that kid back before she's 18. You're making a big mistake. Let me tell you, you are going to build a completely different child. You think you're going to have a lovely, warm relationship. If you don't finish your parenting while she's an adolescent, you're going to blow it. And I could hear it. Like, I could hear it, because, see, I think I know everything. I think I'm so smart. I got this figured out. I don't need your help. But my mind was open enough. I thought, she's right. I gotta get a job. I gotta get out there. I gotta, you know, weave this whole thing back together again. And, you know, I just bring God into every moment, and I would just have blind faith, and I don't peek at the future because it's too damn scary. And I just continue to quiet my mind down, listen to CDs, read spiritual literature. I still, with 12 years of sobriety, I don't have a television. I don't want to zone out. I don't want to go numb. I like to stay with God. I like to be present. I can see that the more I stay awake, the more creativity downloads through me. The more I feel the world, the more I feel a part of, and that's the Creator moving through me. And I love that. It's the most valuable thing I have is my peace. I don't have anything more valuable to give the world. I don't go to hell in a handbasket in a restaurant. You're all, the world's such a safer place with me not an untreated alcoholism. It really is. The streets are safer. Everything's safer. You know, and as time goes on, I did a good thorough 4 and 5, and I've done the steps maybe 4 or 5 times in the 12 years that I've been sober. But I continue to practice the principles in all of my affairs. And if I can't practice the principles in all of my affairs, sometimes I just have to limit an affair. You know, there's been people and situations and family members, I've had to cut them out of my life because I can't handle it. It isn't about them anymore. It's, can I respond instead of react? No. Certain situations make me nuclear reactive. Well, then you don't get to play. Then maybe you need to sit on the sidelines. Then maybe you don't get so many affairs to practice principles in. But at least I know that today. I'm aware of it, you know. I'm not a saint. I'm just willing to grow along spiritual lines. You know, I'm not the message. I'm just a messenger. I'm not perfect. I'm a woman that's trying to live a God-conscious life. You know, I can tell you one thing. I don't lie, cheat, and steal. I don't have a big secret in my closet that, oh, God, if they ever found out, like, my bigger, more gigantic defects, thank you, God. Right now, they're treated and they've been lifted. I live a very simple life. I work. I have my own business. I work 7 days a week. I work with others. I attend 4 meetings a week. I talk to alcoholics all over the United States and sometimes all over the world. I don't sponsor in a super-duper conventional way where we sit with a book and a highlighter and underline stuff. I'm more of looking at their thought process and seeing, were they with self? What are they chewing on? What's their mind doing? Can you bring God into this scenario? I'm much more of a hands-on person. It doesn't mean that I don't love the print, that the 12 and 12 and the big book. And Emmett Fox's Sermon on the Mount is a huge part of my life. I love the Beatitudes and As a Man Thinketh. But I really think that for most people, if we don't all go inwardly and look at what our thought life is doing, because it's completely infected with untreated alcoholism for most of us, it's a parasitic thing, and it's going on all the time. And if I don't look at that and see that and treat that, all bets are off. I can show up to as many meetings as I want, have all the years and all the chips and all of this and all of that. And everybody in here knows somebody that's got like 20 or 30 years and they're so dry they could spontaneously combust. Like, you think to yourself, man, I wish you would just drink and get this over with. You need a new bottom. I don't want to be her. I don't want to be her. I want to be open. I want to be receptive. I want to apologize when I'm wrong. I want to promptly admit it. I want to be friends with people. I want brotherly and harmonious action, and those aren't just words. I really desire that in my heart. I want to be a patient person. I want to be a forgiving person. You know, my daughter's 27 years old today. We're very, very close. We have a good relationship. We talk almost every single day. She's a musician. She's in a band. She travels most of the time. But it's good. It's healed. My relationship with my mother is healed. You know, there are some relationships that may never get healed. I don't have to feel guilty. That's another myth in AA. I just thought, God, I didn't inventory it right, or I didn't do the amends right, or if I had just done, you know, it's all on God's time, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I just have to learn to be patient and allow life to unfold. I don't have to have a crystal ball. I don't have to have a Thomas guide. I don't have to know the next indicated step. It's more just being in the present moment that's going to treat my disease and help me to be a better person in the day that I'm in. Future surfing and thinking about tomorrow and next week is just the most horrible place. The next thing you know, I have a mosquito bite on my neck and now it's lymphoma and I think I need chemo and I'm going to be bald in my hair. I mean, it takes a split second, just one little thing and I'm gone, gone and running. For me, I have to be so careful to babysit my thought life and not allow my mind to hijack me. And I'm not saying I've got the monopoly on AA. There are so many ways for people to recover. God is infinite, and God comes in the most infinite ways. My way isn't the only way. I'm just talking about my life, and I'm talking about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so blessed. I've been given so much more than I ever bargained for, and I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you so much for letting me share. Thanks. Aww.